Welcome back, everybody, to the XCast X-Files Podwatch. This is episode 48 of our whistle-stop tour of the X-Files, from the pilot to My Struggle 2, as we inexorably head towards new episodes in 2018. Today, we're covering the final two episodes of the fourth season, Demons and Gethsemane. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I've been joined once again today by the co-author of the Complete X-Files book and the writer of the Secret Sun blog, Chris Knowles. Hi, Chris.
Hello, here I am.
Here you are. So the fact that you're back with me today suggests that you didn't wake up in a hotel room covered in somebody else's blood with no idea how you got there, unlike Mulder.
Not today, no. I mean, that usually happens to me on a Sunday, but not this particular Sunday.
All right, so that ham-fisted segue leads me into Demons, which is the first of our two episodes today. This aired for the first time in May of 1997, so it's just over 20 years ago at this point. It's the 23rd episode of Season 4, written by R.W. Goodwin and directed by Kim Manners. This is the episode that begins with Mulder waking up in a hotel room covered in blood and suffering from amnesia. Okay, just quickly then, when we were talking about Wet Wired, which was the penultimate episode of the previous season, we talked a bit about sort of the authorship of that one and how it was credited to Matt Beck, but the other writers may have shepherded it through production. What about this one then? So R.W. Goodwin, of course, usually the director of the premiere and the finale of the Vancouver seasons. What do you know about how the script was developed here?
Well, Goodwin had always wanted to write something, and it was sort of a running conversation with he and Chris Carter. And I guess there was an opening at the end of the season, and you know, Chris Carter said, "You're up." Bob Goodwin, apparently, I guess he wrote most of this while he was on vacation with his family. As far as I know, this is mostly a Goodwin script. I'm sure there were rewrites and polishes by Carter and probably Frank Spotnitz later on in the process. But this is, as far as I know, mostly a Bob Goodwin script. And the impetus for this sort of comes out of that he had, again, I mean, people on this show just worked night and day, round the clock sometimes. People were just exhausted. And Bob Goodwin, who I think is really the unsung hero, the great unsung hero of the X-Files, and you really feel how strong his presence and his contributions were right away at the beginning of the sixth season, when there's just a radical tonal shift. The acting is, you know, particularly the supporting acting is radically different. I think one of the, you know, the great things about Bob Goodwin is that not only did he develop the look of the series, but he was also very involved in the day-to-day production, obviously. But I really feel that Bob Goodwin wanted everything to err on the side of understatement. And like I said, I mean, you really feel that contrast in the first half of the sixth season, where, you know, I always feel like the character actors they're all saying, "Look at me, Ma," you know. I mean, it's like particularly in the beginning, I just think the character acting on that episode is horrendously bad. But anyhow, so Bob Goodwin was really exhausted, and he was really stressed out pretty much all the time. And he was planning on leaving the show at the end of this season five anyway, whether the show moved to Los Angeles or not. But he had got one of these sort of new age contraptions. It was supposed to be something that worked on the alpha waves or the beta waves of the brain, and it was supposed to help you relax. And, you know, you lie down, you put these goggles on, and they sort of shoot light patterns at you and things like that. And it gave him just like tremendous headaches, and everyone in his family that tried it had terrible reactions to it. Just it gave them migraines. That was the germ of the idea. I mean, he said he always wanted to, you know, the premise where Mulder wakes up and he's covered in somebody else's blood in a hotel room. You know, Bob Goodwin had always wanted to write a story that started that way. And it's interesting because I think the script was in development throughout the fourth season, because that same premise sort of shows up in an episode of Millennium called Walkabout. I can't say enough about this episode. I think this is one of the great underdogs of the X-Files series. I've noticed that a lot of fans and critics don't seem to respond very well to this episode, but I think it's phenomenal. Again, it's this whole idea of the X-Files existing in a real world context. You know, it's not a vampire story or a ghost story, an alien story. It has to do with real events, real technology, real threats. I mean, these are the episodes that I find scary. You know, people might be scared by Tombs or The Host. I'm scared by this episode because it's real. The doctor in this is based on a guy named Sidney Gottlieb, who ran the MK Ultra mind control program for the CIA. Basically, the analogy here that Goodwin is drawing is that, you know, Mulder is under the clutches and under the influence of a CIA MK Ultra ad scientist, witch doctor, and that's what really gives this episode that kind of punch for me. That it feels very real, and I mean there's so much else going on in this episode that I can watch this episode like just scene by scene and just rewatch the scene and then, you know, go forward a bit in the story and then rewatch the scene. I mean, there's so many great moments here, tremendous acting by everyone involved. It's just a tremendous piece of writing, I think.
Yeah, I really like the premise because I see it as being kind of like a really strong, like a film noir premise almost, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I love the, you know, the sequence of those early scenes. You know, what do I do? Oh, the first thing I do is call Scully, and then I find out where my car's gone, and so on and so forth. And I love that procedural part of the episode. Right, what do you think about the flashback sequences? I mean, I think they're very visually interesting and arresting. I'm not sure exactly how they achieve the effect, but I'm thinking of, like, the grainy look of the film and the kind of heightened color palette.
Yeah, they actually use a special camera lens. You know, I'm not exactly sure how it was done, but they used a process where frames would be taken out. So it gives it that sort of jumpy, hyperstatic feeling.
Yeah, and I'd imagine it was, you know, whatever they did, it would have been time consuming. And it doesn't, they don't, those sequences are very memorable. They don't take up much screen time. But I think it's probably kind of like a trademark of the X-Files, that how much effort went into the series, as you've talked about to me before.
Yeah, I mean, this is like one of these things that's like, oh, well, you know, we'll do it in post. I mean, the post-production process on this episode, and these guys must have just been working around the clock. Because, I mean, that's a feature film kind of. I mean, of course, shows like CSI, that family of you know, procedural dramas. Mm. I mean, they do that thing all the time. It just shows you just how influential The X-Files was on the television landscape, that just throwaway element, not necessarily throwaway, but just an element that was just used once in an episode of The X-Files became the basic framing mechanism of an entire series, an entire franchise, really. So that just shows you just how influential the series was. And, you know, as time goes on, I mean, I think people lose sight of that because, you know, television is such a big thing now. I mean, there's so many very highly regarded series, but people forget that The X-Files really changed the landscape. I mean, it reset, you know, the program, and it rewrote the rules.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely the aesthetics of the series don't get enough consideration. Not to the extent they should have, anyway. And this is a good example, I think.
Yeah, just to show you, I mean, like, one of the scenes I'll just watch over and over again, and this might sound completely insane to people, but the scene when Mulder and Scully go to the Cassandra's house, yeah. You know, not their summer house, but their residence.
Yeah.
And just that confrontation with the maid, who that actress is, I mean, she hasn't really been in a lot since. And, you know, I guess she found something else to do. I mean, I don't know what the actress is doing now, but she's tremendous in this. I mean, there are actors that appeared on The X-Files who put in, you know, immeasurably better performances on The X-Files than they put in, you know, other things that I've seen those same actors in. So, I mean, I think that the diligence and that work ethic behind The X-Files brought out the best in these actors. You know, another example is Jay Avaconi, who plays the detective. Look at his performance, you know, under the Bob Goodwin regime, and then look at his performance in Existence and Permanum. It's almost like two different actors. His performance here, like I said, it's almost like he's a different actor than, you know, the character we see, the Duffy Haskell character, you know, who almost seems like sort of florid in that role. again, Bob Goodwin had such a huge impact on the aesthetics and the aura of the show. I think a lot of that X-Files mystique really comes from his contributions, and I think they're undervalued.
Yeah, and I guess because he directed comparatively few episodes, obviously some great ones, but that may be why Manners and Bowman get more of the attention, I don't know. When we were discussing Conduit, we got to talking about the different versions of the Samantha Mulder abduction, and you brought up Chris Carter's rationale for that, which I thought was very interesting, about how memory is negotiable and so on.
It's fluid, you know. The thing that he said is that, you know, these memories are being recovered through hypnosis.
Obviously, Mulder's going through this very, very dubious, questionable medical technique to recover these memories, which he'll have which he won't be able to have 100% certainty that if he does recover them, they are exactly what happened. This is not the way to the truth, Mulder, Scully says, and she's right, probably on more than one level there. But the idea of memory and subjectivity in the X-Files, you've talked about it being very important to the series as a whole, but particularly important to an episode like this.
Yeah, and, you know, he's under the influence of ketamine, you know, which is actually an animal tranquilizer that's used as a recreational hallucinogenic. He's under the influence of what is clearly meant to be an MKUltra doctor. So there are so many undercurrents at work here that inform that POV type of storytelling that is really the central focus of the X-Files. The scenes that you talked about, the flashback scenes, I think are really the most powerful in the series history. You know, the technique that they use, the film technique that they use, I think just gives them a sense of urgency, a sort of sense of crisis that, say, the scene in Little Green Men that I feel lacks. But here, you know, particularly with Chris Owens playing Cigarette Smoking Man, you know, and it's just that little line, you know, you're a little spy, you know.
Yeah.
You get the sense that is developed in the confrontation with Mulder and his mother. Again, one of my favorite scenes in the series history. When the mother refuses to answer the question, it basically answers the question, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, we know at this point in time that she had a relationship with him and that he is Mulder's father, you know, his biological father. I mean, we know that for sure at this point in the series history. I mean, it's articulated in a Morfati, but, you know, for people who pay attention to the X-Files storytelling, it's all spelled out here.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I think that's, you know, again, this is a really undervalued episode. And I've read some fan theories that that Mulder is sort of still under the influence of this treatment and this drug in Gethsemane and Redux and so on and so forth. I mean, I'm not necessarily sure that is the inference they're trying to draw here, but it is interesting timing.
So Gethsemane, written by Chris Carter, directed by R.W. Goodwin, is the episode in which Mulder heads to the Yukon territory to recover what's said to be an alien corpse. Meanwhile, Scully's health at the same time is worsening. Right, so you've alluded to this one in some previous episodes, so I'm interested to get your take on this. I've got some issues with this episode, but I think that you can tell that Carter's very, very confident in what he's doing here, I think. I mean, he's dealing with these weighty themes, as he does at other times, admittedly, but, you know, here it's about the belief in a deity and how meaningful would it be to discover extraterrestrial life and, you know, confronting your own mortality and so on. And I don't know, I think he puts it over with a bit of panache. What do you think?
Oh, the scene on the stairwell just gives me chills. When Scully says, you know, this, you know, discovering the truth about extraterrestrials is, you know, not my last dying wish. And she literally means that, you know, I mean, that's a fantastic line, you know, which I'm misquoting, but just the fact that Mulder, you know, Scully, he's aware that Scully is taking a downturn, that her health is deteriorating, but it doesn't matter to him because somebody found an alien in a block of ice in the Yukon. It shows that as much as he feels for her and feels protective of her, that the quest is still the primary focus of his entire life. You know, like I said, I'm not really crazy about the Mulder skeptic arc here, and I know the writers weren't they weren't really crazy about having to write this arc, and you know, they sort of made pointed barbs in the fan press about that. It doesn't ring true for me until Redux 2, where this radical shift in his focus is put in the context of the fact that this quest, you know, is killing people. It's endangering people. You know, the people that are closest to him have died because of this quest. You know, it isn't just that I've just been, you know, set up and let down one too many times, and this is just the last straw. And, you know, how many times do you think he heard a conversation or a lecture that, you know, Christgau had given him? I'm sure he got it all the time. You know, I mean, that's the thing. You know, Christgau is obviously just a plot device at this point in the series arc, but it's like, how many times do you think Mulder heard that same lecture? I mean, he probably heard it like once a month at least, you know, and it's probably just probably what he was constantly hearing. I just think the real Mulder would have just tuned that out. It's just like, shut up. You know, I've heard this a million times before. It doesn't matter to me. You know, I've seen too much. I've experienced too much to just chuck it all out because of just one guy.
Yeah.
You know, some shadowy figure from the Defense Department, you know, tells me it's the truth.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that this episode asks us to accept, you know, the biggest of emotional shifts from Mulder, and I don't think it sells it well enough. Because it happens so late in the episode as well. It's kind of like 3 minutes from the end when Critchgow's telling him that stuff or something like that. Even though I like John Finn as Critchgow, I think he does his job well, you know.
Yeah, great actor. Yeah, it just doesn't carry over. I think that there was some arm twisting going on here. I think, you know, David Duchovny really wanted his character to be somebody else, probably more like David. I know David really likes to play himself. Californication is basically just David playing himself. I mean, I think that's his favorite character. So I think he just wanted to play a character that was closer to himself than to this character that had been created for the series. And I think, you know, this is around the time that he's, you know, renegotiations are coming up, you know, contract renewals. You know, I think there was a bit of arm twisting here. I think there were maybe some ultimatums and things like that. Carter and Spotnitz just could not write this whole arc off fast enough. I mean, it's gone by the end of The Red and the Black, right? I mean, that's halfway into the fifth season. It's just like, get rid of this. No, this doesn't work. Just stop. You know? The interesting thing is, too, is that after, and this is something that I don't think a lot of fans really pay attention to, is that there was it wasn't extreme, but there was a definite drop off in the viewership after the Gethsemane and Ducks. The show starts to begin this very gentle sloping downwards in the ratings. And certainly, I think the hardcore online fan community, I mean, I can't count how many times I've heard, oh, I like the X-Files, you know, seasons 1 through 4. You know, what they're saying is that I like the X-Files before Michael Critchgau. I think that a lot of viewers kind of felt betrayed by this development in the character and in the series. It's just like, you know, I don't think they necessarily recognize that or articulate it particularly well, but I think that there was like a break of faith with the audience in this particular arc. I mean, I think it's overall, I mean, it's one, you know, it's like a feat, technical feat that, you know, the production, they chilled an entire sound set to 21 degrees below zero. I think this was the most expensive shoot in the series history up to that point. You know, again, it's that feature film commitment that Carter was always trying to impart. And I think the production staff really rose to the challenge here. But again, I mean, it's just all the elements are in place. You know, the writing is very strong. You have very convincing dialogue between Mulder and Scully. But at the same time, it's just there are just these sort of false notes. Maybe they take you out of the story more than everyone would like, you know, have intended. And again, that this whole thing where he's about to commit suicide or whatever at the end of the episode, it's just like they didn't earn that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's I think it's very ambitious to get somebody to that point in a single episode, especially with so much else going on. Yeah, they didn't quite do it. I'm glad you mentioned the production, because that definitely is worth referring to. So all that stuff in the mountains, there's a real sweep to it, isn't there? Even Mark Snow's score has kind of an epic feel to it as well at times. And production-wise, they're really on all cylinders at this point, even though they had a lot of other things to think about. There's a movie coming up and so on. But yeah, that side of things is hard to fault here.
Yeah, no, again, it's one of these episodes that if you weren't really a committed X-Files fan who's rewatched all the episodes several times and, you know, really invested in the characters and the storyline, you know, if you're a more casual fan, I don't think you'd really have a problem with any of this. More casual fans, you know, fans less invested in the mythology arc, I don't think they would necessarily have any problem with this. I mean, I think they'd probably think this is a great episode.
Yeah, and they'd probably think it was a great cliffhanger. I believe at this point, Duchovny had made some noises in the press about not being the happiest and so on. So I'm not really sure how people reacted and responded to that cliffhanger.
I don't think anybody thought that Mulder was going to be killed off.
Yeah, because the movie's public knowledge, I guess, by this point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody knows the feature film is coming. Nobody's going to assume that they're just going to write him off and he's going to show up as a ghost in the feature film, or they're going to do it all in flashbacks. So yeah, again, and it's not convincing. It just doesn't have that punch that, you know, that say the end of Anasazi would have. And again, I mean, what we have coming up next is the way people think about the Blessing Way is the way I think about Redux One. You know, it's almost like there are some great scenes in it. Brilliantly directed by Bob Goodwin. The visuals, you know, some of the scenes, like the scene between Skinner and Scully in the corridor, I just think is phenomenal. But, you know, all those voiceovers, it's just like an enduring text. And that whole monologue by Kritschkow, it just scrapes the ears. It just does not sound like the way people talk. I mean, Gethsemane can't be understood as an episode unto itself. I mean, it's a triptych, but it really is. It's a story in three acts. Yeah. It's a three act story. This is the first act. As a piece of production, I'm sure everybody in the production offices of all these different TV shows that on at the time, you know, were studying that, like, oh my God, you know, how he's raised the bar here. How do we cope with this? You know, and like I think the dialogue is very strong. It's very crisp. You know, it doesn't have that sort of tendency towards floridness and purpleness that Carter can sort of lapse into at times. But I just think the premise.
Yeah, it's a really hard sell.
Yeah, they're doing their best to sell it. Like I said, probably for a lot of people, they did sell it. But like I said, at the same point in time, you start to see this sort of drifting off. You know, maybe some of the more casual viewers are starting to drift off. I mean, let's remember in the context of the history here is that I just remember that year, the fifth season, the X-Files just dominated everything, you know, in the run-up to the movie and the Songs in the Key of X that was released. And it's like, that was front and center in the pop culture. It was dominant. It was dominant in the way that I don't think shows really have been since that time. You know, when you start to see the rise of cable and people are starting to just watch shows on tape. I mean, it's like, you know, that was appointment television at its most hyper focused. So if you're overanalyzing it like we do, it might ring false, but it certainly didn't hurt the popularity of or the mystique of the show as a phenomenon, as a pop culture phenomenon. Because again, I mean, it's like that fifth season, you know, is really the X-Files at its apex, you know, within the context of the overall culture.
Tomorrow, someone else is going to be taking a look at Redux and Redux 2. I'm not sure who. So hopefully whoever it is has more tolerance for monologues and walking down corridors than sounds like Chris does.
I mean, Redux 2, I think Redux 2 is phenomenal. I think it's a highlight. And as a recovery, it's like, you know, one of the greatest comebacks of all time. You know, it's like going from like a star and a half episode to like a five-star episode, like, you know, the blink of an eye. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's the strongest of the trio, I think. Okay, so find us on Twitter at @X_cast. Find us on Facebook. Find our group and come and join us there. Until next time, listeners, trust no one.